Well, good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our eighth series of presentations on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Library. My name is Ryan Coops, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate the series with my colleague, him with the gray hair back there, Peggy Wright. I've gained a few gray hairs doing the series myself. With assistance from Haiwan Wan, the virtual library coordinator for WKU. Our technical coordinator tonight is David Renner, the library's technology coordinator. Our speaker tonight is Western's most traveled faculty member. As of 2007, his travels have taken him more than 2.8 million miles from around the globe and to every continent. In 2006 alone, he traveled 110,000 miles. And already this year, 2007, his travels have taken him to England, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, South Africa, Scotland, Canada, and Russia, with future trips planned to Morocco, Mali, Gabon, and the Central African Republic. And this is not to mention domestic travel from San Francisco to New York, and even a side trip to Alaska. He's also our most popular speaker, and now tonight makes his sixth appearance in this series. A native of the United Kingdom, David grew up in Shrewsbury, where he worked briefly as an accountant while playing drums and singing in Crackdown, a local band. He spent most of the 1970s in Australia working in the hospitality business, and from 1973 to 1987, he worked as an international tax consultant in Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. By the early 1980s, he was vice president and CFO of Signal Communications in New Orleans, Louisiana. Fortunately for us, an academic career beckoned, and he returned to graduate school and obtained a PhD in geography at the University of Oregon. He joined the faculty at WKU in 1993, and became head of the Department of Geography and Geology in 2001. He's the author of numerous publications, including two major monographs, Buenos Aires Global Dreams, Local Crises, which was published by Wiley, and Contemporary Argentina, published by Westview Press. He's presently at work on a new monograph on place, culture, and popular music. Last November, he traveled to the Sahara as an expedition lecturer for the American Geographical Society's Education Expedition Program. And he's a return trip planned for this October. Please join me in welcoming David Keelan.
Thank you, Ryan. I get some feedback here, like move backwards forwards. Well, appreciate you all coming out this evening, and appreciate the long-winded introduction. I just feel tired listening to all that stuff. But, you know, if I didn't have a full-time job, I could actually do more travel. You know? But I guess you got to take care of business. Well, I hope this lecture is not going to be too dry. We're going to be in the Sahara here and see a little sand, a few dunes, and a yeah, look, this is one of those places that really captures the imagination when you think about the Sahara. And typically with this series, we've gone to individual countries. We've visited perhaps Mexico or Australia, etc. But this time we're doing something a little different. We're looking at a region, right? Because it is such a fascinating region and is such a complex culture area, such a complex physical area, that it really does merit treatment as this faraway place with maybe not a strange-sounding name, but certainly some strange things going on in the Sahara. So I hope you enjoy our little journey through the Sahara this evening. I have to make sure that I don't get in front of that thing and make it squeal. Don't want to squeal. That's better. So one of the things we like to do as geographers when we run around the world and we look at different places and talk to different people is read the landscape. It's one of the things that we're trained to do as geographers, and it's one of the things that you all do every day of your lives as you're moving around, is that you read the landscape. You look at what's going on, what's different, what's the same, how things are changing. And one of the things we like to do as we go through the landscape is what we call interpret with a geographer's eye. And one of the things that I do both in the classroom and on these lecture trips that I do with the American Geographical Society, is speak to people just like yourself about geography, about what geographers do and how we see the landscape. And the Sahara is one of those areas that is interpretively rich. There's just an amazing number of things that you can look at, analyze, see, or read on the landscape. And I'm going to go through a few of those things with you tonight. We're very interested in sort of these basic themes, locations, you know, where are these places, what do these places look like, how do people interact with the environment socially, politically, what are the connections, how do you get there, you got to ride a camel for 3 days to get to the grocery store, regions, and of course we'll explain in a minute what we mean by a region. One of the things that really fascinates me when I go to these faraway places are these questions of interactions. You know, and these are sort of the meat and potatoes of geography. How do people interact? What do they do? How are humans shaping the environment? What does this mean practically? What are the characteristics of these people and this place? So what? Why do we care about these issues? What does it have to do with our lives and our communities? What are the implications of what's going on? It may surprise you to know that one of the things that might surprise you is that, you know, all this discussion about hurricanes and the different seasons, the different types of hurricanes that we might have, the strengths and weaknesses, etc., intimately related to the Sahara. There's lots and lots of research now to show that what happens in the Sahara, the types of climate patterns that develop in the Sahara, the amount of dust in the atmosphere that comes out of the Sahara is intimately related with the formation of tropical hurricanes and the types of weather patterns that hit the east coast of the United States. So you learn all sorts of interesting things about what's going on in these strange and wonderful places. Connections are something that I've personally been working on a lot in my research, transportation, and I'm very interested how people get, this was the last tour group that went through, by the way, you know, times are tough in the Sahara. How are people and places connected? You know, when you look at the Sahara, you see this expanse of territory, and you see the lack of facilities, and you ask questions, well, how do people get around? How do they interact? How do they economically engage? What types of connections are there? It really makes you think about accessibility and mobility in a different context when you think about how people are trying to develop themselves. Trade networks. Why are certain communities better off than others? Why do you have better economic relationships between some regions and not others? What are the links between places? And again, the Sahara is a really interesting place to look at those questions because it has so many parts to it. It is a very complex region. So why is the Sahara region? What is it that makes this set of countries, this set of places a region? And of course, there are lots of different ways that you can explain regions. One of the things that we do as geographers is ask questions about characteristics. What types of characteristics do you find in a particular area that would allow it to be described as a region? And it's pretty obvious. If you think about the South, you think about characteristics of the South, most people would have trouble defining the boundary of the South, but we all know where it is, right? Because you're all funny down here, you know? Different food, you know? So you can figure out what some of the basic characteristics are. And so one of the things we do when we go to these different places is try and understand how people think about themselves. How do they see themselves in a regional context? What does Sahara mean to them? Because we sort of know what it means to us. We have this stereotypical image of this Saharan landscape. And so what we find out is that people's conceptions or perceptions of regions change depending on where you are. And if you talk to some of these people that live in the middle of the Sahara, and you say, well, you know, back home we think the Sahara, this vast sort of dry, uninhabited place, they'll look at you like you're crazy. It's like, what? There's an incredible amount of things going on here. Resources, activity, all sorts of things going on. Very, very different perceptions sometimes. Africa is huge, generally. But the Sahara is pretty big as well. If you just look where the United States is compared to roughly the Sahara, Right? The Sahara is a big piece of territory. It essentially extends from the Nile River and the Sudan all the way across northern Africa, up to the Mediterranean Sea, and out to the Atlantic, all the way down to the Western Sahara and southern Morocco. This is a big chunk of territory. So to ride across this stretch of land on a camel would take you a while. You couldn't do it in a vehicle, that's for sure. So let's have a look at sort of basic physical characteristics, and then we'll look at some of the cultural characteristics of this area. For those of you that have a geological bent, and there's a few of you in the audience, I can tell by the way you twitch when we talk about geology, this entire area sits on what's called the African Shield. And this is a really, really, really old area that's incredibly stable, no major volcanoes, no major earthquake activities. It's really, really stable, really, really old, and it goes back over 600 million years. So it's a really old piece of landscape. But the Sahara itself is incredibly young. This is a very, very recent landscape. In geologic time, it's like that, an instant. In human time, you know, we can't remember what we had for breakfast yesterday, but in geologic time, this just was just yesterday. So the Sahara is incredibly young, and that really shapes what goes on physically and culturally in this area, as we'll see in a little while. It's a very, very young landscape. Those of you that know about plate tectonics, I'm sure everybody's heard of that now. It's a pretty well-established theory. You can see nicely how South America and Africa sort of fit together if you go back in geologic time. About 2 billion years ago, you've got these very, very old, what are called basement rocks, which define the landscape of both South America and Africa. So there's some geologic connection there. You can sort of think about the age of this landscape. And if you look at the little globe at the bottom, you can see all these land masses sort of fit together in the last version of Pangaea. And of course, as we know today, the Atlantic Ocean is spreading apart, so Africa is moving further away from the Western Hemisphere, and we're all getting closer to Tokyo. So in a few million years, we'll just be a suburb of China. Mountain building crosses, there are actually lots and lots of mountains in the Sahara. One of the things that is surprising to a lot of people, because you think, well, the Sahara is just this vast landscape of just sand dunes, just lots of sand. Actually, it's mostly mountains. It's mostly rocks and mountains, lots and lots of big clusters of mountains. Most of these are fairly old, about 250 or so million years ago, but the limestones, the depositions, contain very important sources of what we call paleo water, really old water, and oil, of course, is a big part of this picture. And some of you may have read in the newspaper, probably about 6 months ago, there was an interesting story about what our good friend and close ally now, Muammar Gaddafi, is doing in Libya. They're actually sucking water out of the Sahara Desert. There's this whole artesian basin in the central Sahara Desert that is being sucked out by the Libyans. And the Egyptians are really concerned because there's a theory that that basin is linked to the Nile, and that if they suck enough water out, all the Nile water is actually going to go down into the basin, and Egypt will be dry, which is not a pretty thought. Only 15% of the Sahara is actually sand, right? 85% mountains and gravel rock plains. And for the first 2 weeks that we were in this region, we couldn't find a sand dune. We sent out expeditions. We had camel drives. We had people going out looking for sand dunes because everybody said, I want a picture of a Saharan sand dune. Not one in sight. Lots and lots of pebbles, gravel rock plains, mountains. No sand dunes. Right? So you have to really look for sand dunes. All of the yellow here is this sedimentary or limestone base, and of course, this is all important sources of oil and uranium. Right? The mineral deposits here over the last few million years are very important. So in the North African area, of course, and down in the Gulf of Guinea, around Nigeria, lots and lots of oil resources. We were very, very close in Agadez, which you can see there on the map, a little red dot, very close to a source of uranium. Some of you may remember a year or so ago, 2 years ago, that whole kerfuffle about the U.S. sending somebody into Niger to find out if they were selling uranium to whomever, I don't know. But there is actually uranium in Niger, quite a bit of uranium. The Sahara is dynamic. It's not a static landscape. It goes through these cycles of wet and dry, wet and dry, wet and dry, constantly, every 10, 15,000 years, wet and dry, wet and dry. If you look on the left-hand side, that shows you between 16 and 20,000 years ago, extreme desert. 5,000 years ago, grasslands and semi-desert. We'll see a picture in a minute that shows that there were giraffes and elephants and all sorts of grasslands in the Sahara. Then, about 4,000 years ago, the Sahara went from a fairly moist subtropical environment back to a desert. And so this is a very dynamic landscape that changes. In another 5,000 years, theoretically, it'll be back to more of a tropical savanna grassland environment again. That's if global climate change doesn't destroy everything we know and love about this planet. We don't know yet. But certainly in 5,000 years, this cycle likely will repeat itself. It's a very dry environment, as we said. It doesn't get a lot of rainfall. Most of the rainfall is in this subtropical belt shown on these lines there, where you'll get during the summer months, you'll get rainfall that'll move up into the Sahel, which is this sort of grassland belt to the south of the Sahara. In the Sahara Desert itself, it really doesn't rain very much. Maybe 2 to 3 inches of rain on average throughout the Sahara region. It's quite dry for most of this area. When you get around the Mediterranean basin area, you'll get more of a Mediterranean climate, so you'll get a little more precipitation. But for the most part, this is a fairly arid environment. And so you can imagine how that impacts people's daily lives. Having to live in that environment, you can't grow tomatoes in the Sahara. But in fact, you can, if you know the right place and if you can find the springs. The Tuareg, for example, this group of semi-nomadic that lives up in the area around southern Algeria, southern Libya, Niger, they actually have villages in the Air Mountains where they have these gardens that are fed by springs where they actually grow tomatoes and melons and enough food to serve the local community. So depending on the conditions, you can actually provide good food. The Sahara is changing, and changing because of human activity. Right? And again, it doesn't matter what your politics are on global climate change, the reality is that global change and climate change is a reality. Right? And humans have an impact. And just looking at this model here that shows pre-industrial rainfall in the 18th century, and now rainfall in the 1980s as an average, you can see that even with this normal pattern of climate change over long periods of time, just in 200 years, which geologically is incredibly quick, there has been dramatic change just in rainfall regimes in the Sahara. So humans are having an impact on these changing dynamics in one way or another, and rainfall is just one of them. This is also a really fascinating region in terms of a cultural transition zone. This is where the Arabic Muslim world meets the sub-Saharan Melodic Black African world. It's a transition zone that is complex, that at times can be very bloody, that is always fascinating. Whenever you get these transitional contact zones, you get all sorts of interesting issues that arise. And this area is no exception, where you have a strong cultural imprint of Islam as a religion, of Arabic as a language, of trade, historical trade between the Mediterranean basin and sub-Saharan Africa, trade in salt, trade in gold, trade in other precious metals, trade in slaves, which is a big part of this economy. You get very interesting relationships that emerge. And this transition zone is quite fascinating in many ways. So you have lots of cultural conflicts, frictions that have occurred over time. And of course, the most obvious ones are these Muslim-Christian conflicts that you see from time to time. The most recent evidence of that, of course, is in the Darfur region of the Sudan, where you have lots of problems. Religion is just one of many problems, but it's a big issue in terms of the Christian South and the Muslim North in the Sudan. Nomadism, of course, if you think about people like the Tuareg that have for thousands of years used the Sahara as their home, And of course, in the 19th century, along come the colonial powers with their rulers and red pens, say, well, we're going to draw a border here. Right? Now, on that side of the border is Algeria. On this side of the border is Libya. On that south of the border is Niger. Which country do you want to belong to? Well, we don't want to belong to any of those countries. We're the Tuareg. Right? We live in the Sahara. Oh, but you have to belong to one of those countries. But we don't want to belong to... Well, you do. You know, lots and lots of issues related to nomadism and, of course, environmental problems as you go into an area like the Sahara that is ecologically very sensitive for oil and gas exploration, uranium, minerals, whatever it might be. There are implications in the local cultural and physical environment. Sahel, of course, this zone that separates the true Sahara today from the subtropical south, simply is an Arabic word that means border or margin. It simply says, well, this is where you get this transition area. Ethnically African, but culturally Arab in this transition zone, which is very interesting. Desertification, of course, is a major challenge in this transition zone because of these changing climate patterns, environmental exploitation. All through this area, there's been a long history predating colonialism and into the modern period of cultural and political instability. Like colonialism in and of itself didn't cause political instability in sub-Saharan Africa. That's always been there. Colonialism has exacerbated the problem. And of course, these north versus south clashes that we've seen, not only in places like Sudan, but also in Chad. Last year on my trip, we were supposed to go into Chad, but the Chadians said, well, you can't come visit us because you were just in Niger. And then the Sudanese say, well, you can't come visit us because you were going to go to Chad. And so we said, well, we'll go to Egypt instead because they need the money. So all sorts of political problems.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what it means to be ethnically African, culturally Arab?
Oh, ethnically African, but culturally Arab. What that means in places like Niger or Burkina Faso or in Mali, you have Nilotic peoples or Niger peoples, peoples that are ethnically African, black African, but they practice Islam, they may speak Arabic as a primary language, and they have all the cultural values embedded in the Islamic culture environment. So they're really in these two worlds. So what this relates to, of course, is language as a cultural feature of the region where you have Arabic being spoken by most of these peoples, maybe not as their primary language, but certainly as their lingua franca in many areas, the sort of main way to communicate with different groups. And I always love seeing Coca-Cola in different... it looks like Coca-Cola, even though it says squiggle, squiggle, squiggle. Coca-Cola. And of course, because of the impact of colonialism, you also have lots and lots of colonial languages linked in with indigenous languages. So in places like Mali, you'll hear French spoken as the lingua franca among the elite, Arabic spoken by many, many people, particularly in the north, and Bambara spoken as the indigenous language in most of Mali. The same in places like Sudan, Chad, Niger is almost completely French as the dominant language, Burkina Faso, French among the elite. So you sort of have this sort of polyglot of languages that you hear as you move through, where people will switch from indigenous languages to the lingua franca, French, English sometimes, certainly Arabic in many cases. Places like Algeria and Morocco, you have Berber dialects because the Berbers, of course, the original Moors, if you remember the Moorish exploitations in the Iberian Peninsula, the Berber dialect is sort of the major language of that region. And if you just think about the power of Islam, of course, throughout this region, the entire Saharan world was influenced by Islam from the 900s onwards, certainly through trade, but also through religious conquest and these other political relationships. And of course, one of the important roles of Islam in this area was bringing about the ability of many people to read and write, particularly in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, Islam was very, very important in building up the skills of these societies in terms of what we think of today as basic education, ability to read and write, because we had to be able to read the Quran in the original Arabic. So education was incredibly important. And particularly in the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th century, Islam as a religion, but as a social force, was one of the most powerful forces in the world at that time in education and science. And it wasn't until the 15th and 16th centuries, as the West rose with the discovery of the New World, that Islam started to turn inward and take less of a role in education and science, and resulting in some of the problems we see today. If you love music, you have to love the Sahara, because Sahara is where all of our music in this country culturally comes from. Jazz, blues, rock and roll, it all comes out of the Sahara. And there are very few places on the planet that have the complexity of rhythms and melodies and textures in Sahara and Africa. You can hear dozens of different styles of music just in one little community, lots of different instruments. It's an incredibly culturally rich landscape for music. And of course, the language, the different languages spoken by these indigenous groups, played a huge role in the styles of music that developed. Maninka, for example, is one of the most impressive classical musical styles of the Manding people. And you have these wonderful, mostly sung by females, but wonderful melodic songs that you hear all through this region with the griots, the people that practice song and storytelling as a trade. And of course, if you think about the banjo as one of the important instruments of bluegrass in the South, it has its roots in African music. It comes from the ngoni, this instrument that was widely used throughout this Saharan region as one of the major instruments. So there are tremendous connections, because of course all the slaves that came from Africa to the New World, into the Caribbean, into Brazil, into the American South, brought with them these songs, these stories, this musical experiences, blending it with this new cultural environment. And if you ever come across music by people like Fanta Damba and Bamana music, there's djembe drumming, this is really, really cool stuff. I'm sure they've got some here at Barnes & Noble. I get 10% commission, by the way. There's just some really, anything you can get out of the Sahara music, you'll really enjoy it. It's wonderful stuff. What's going on in this region today, in the Sahara and Africa generally? There's been a tremendous growth in this region over the last 50 to 100 years, but growth doesn't necessarily mean development. You've got more people, more jobs, more opportunities, more education, etc., but it doesn't mean these people are developing at the same pace as we might expect. And of course, human movement across borders has been one of the hallmarks of this area in the last 50 years particularly. And the Sahara has emerged as one of the major pathways for people to move from sub-Saharan Africa into Northern Africa or Western Africa, and then across the Mediterranean and into Europe, because Europe today is the destination, just like the United States is the destination for immigrants, both legal and illegal, from Latin America. It's the same with Europe. Tremendous amount of legal and illegal immigration coming out of sub-Saharan Africa, in part because of all the economic and political challenges in this region. Here's the local bus here, the sort of thing you see all over the place. You know, you have to have infrastructure for economic development, of course, and obviously one doesn't expect to see high-speed rails running across the middle of the Sahara. Nice, you know, it'd be great for get around on a high-speed train. But for local communities, if you don't have access to infrastructure, the ability to take your goods to marketplace, it's very, very difficult to develop economically. We'll see some pictures of that in a minute. So peoples and places, just to think a little bit about what's going on in this region visually, what types of things do we observe. This is one of those places, anybody recognize it? You probably won't, because it looks like every dusty Saharan town that you come across. This is fabled Timbuktu, right? Now, I remember when I was growing up as a kid, when I was bad, and believe me, that happened a lot, that my mother always said, you're going to get sent to Timbuktu, you know, because that was like the worst place you could get sent to. I mean, it was really this terrible, terrible place that you want to get sent to. And so I grew up saying, I really want to go to Timbuktu. I'm as bad as I can be, but I haven't gone to Timbuktu yet. And so on this trip, we went to Timbuktu, and it's as bad as everybody says. And, you know, it's a quiet, dusty town. But the amazing thing about this is this seems to be one of the richest cities in Africa. An incredible place with mansions and camel trains coming in and lost European explorers turning up out of the desert. This was the crossroads, north, south, east, west of the Sahara. Gold, salt, all sorts of people, slaves. This was an incredibly wealthy place. And at its height, there was something like 200,000 people living in this community. Timbuktu was as fabulous as it is portrayed in history. It's fallen on hard times, I'm afraid. The only wealth that comes through these days are American and European tourists. It's maybe accommodating probably about 3,000, 4,000 people now. It's still an important caravan site for Tuareg and others that move up and down this landscape. But most people that go there are utterly disappointed when you get off the plane and you start going into town, like, this is Timbuktu. They don't even have a bar, you know. It's whoa. But you know, it's a fascinating place.
Where is it actually located? Does it have an airport?
It actually does have an airport. Yeah, it has an airport that is open on Tuesdays and Thursdays. If the weather's okay, and the weather's usually okay in the Sahara. This is the type of architecture that you'll see all the way through the Saharan region. This is called Sudanese architecture. And it's not because it's from the modern country of Sudan, it's because the Sudanese style was what defined architecture and culture throughout the Saharan region in pre-European history. And so this is the typical type of mosque style that developed from the 8th and 9th century onwards, Sudanese architecture. And you see these all over the Sahara, and this is really the central place. This is like the cathedral would be in a European city or the main square in an American city. It's the sort of focal point for the town and the community.
What do they build?
It's adobe, pretty much. Mud and brick. This is where water comes to the Sahara, and if you look at the map that you have and find the Niger River, the Niger River is one of those interesting little physical anomalies in Africa where it actually rises just a few hundred miles from the Atlantic Ocean in the southwest part of Africa. It actually flows north, it hits the Sahara transition zone, this sort of sandstone rock, and it hits what's called the Big Bend, and there's this big swamp in the middle of the Sahara where you have this big bend, and then it turns and heads south and ends up flowing through Nigeria and ends up entering the Gulf of Guinea down in the South Atlantic. And this is virtually this huge swampy oasis in the middle of the Sahara, the Western Sahara, where you have all of these villages that are able to grow rice and other crops, cassava, other crops in this area. And it has long been one of the cradles of civilization, of great empires. You go back and look 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, that's where you saw some of the great empires develop around this water. Transport the easy way. The best way to travel in the Sahara is on a camel. Now, you got to take your Dramamine, because, you know, those things tend to move a little bit. But it's the best way to get around. I can strongly recommend the camel ride if you ever get a chance to do it. It's a lot of fun. You got to choose your camel drivers carefully, though, because some camels are a little mean, and some camel drivers are meaner. You got to be a little careful. One of the big problems for camel trains and state security in places like Niger, Mali, is a tremendous amount of drugs and weaponry is moved through the Sahara on these camel trains. So, you know, this one here, we didn't stop and ask them how much marijuana they had or what weapons they were carrying, but they probably have a little bit of ganja stacked away on this camel train. That's the easy way to get around. This is the hard way to get around. Right? This is I-65 in Niger. Right? And we had a caravan of 21 of these jeeps, three of which worked reasonably well. The other 18 needed a little repair along the way. We met up with this camel train coming south as we were going north, and neither one of us wanted to give way. Of course, we couldn't go up the side of the hill. The camels could. So we had to have a little negotiation, you know, pay a little money, and everyone was happy. This is not an easy landscape to get around. There aren't a lot of interstates and infrastructure. We were off-road for 3 days. We spent one whole day driving 200 miles down a riverbed. And if you've ever driven in soft sand at 40 miles an hour with a crazy driver, better to be on a camel. The friendly Tuareg. This is one of the most interesting cultural groups that you can find anywhere in the world, because they have this incredibly fierce reputation as warriors, which they are. They're known as the Blue People because the men are the ones that wear the full veil and dress all in blue, and the indigo in their cloaks, of course, gets in their skin, so when they take their cloaks off, they look blue. It's scary stuff when you see that. And they have this reputation of fighting with the Nigerian government, the Algerian government, the Libyan government. They'll fight with anybody. We were supposed to be going to Niger on this trip coming up in October, but the Tuareg are now engaged in a little skirmish, it's being reported in the press, with the Nigerian military, and so it's not advised that anybody go into the Tuareg area right now, because they don't care where you're from or who you're with. If you're not Tuareg, you gotta be really careful. But they're actually really, really wonderful people. Really, no, they're very wonderful people. Yeah. They move around in these amazingly colorful caravans, and what you'll notice is that some of these women, they're very dark skinned. They actually have, they're not slaves, but they have indigenous Africans or black Africans that work in their tribe as sort of indentured labor, but they're responsible for, you know, helping to raise the kids, for sort of growing some crops, for loading up the caravans and moving things around. They sort of act as servants, and there's this symbiotic relationship between these two groups. And the Tuareg, of course, they move around constantly. They're nomadic, semi-nomadic. They don't like to be settled in one place, and they sure don't like growing vegetables. That's not what they do. Right? They'll have their servants grow the vegetables. They like to be out riding the camels and waging war, even if it's only pretend, and sort of sharpening their swords. And they're very nice people. Saharan village life is much like you would expect in any village, you know, from a sociological perspective. They have all the same types of relationships that we find in any community. Just the context is different in terms of who has responsibility for doing what, who gathers the water, who tends the animals, who is responsible for security, etc. It's a very eye-opening experience for us in the West to go into these communities and see the types of things that are going on in these areas. One of the neat things about the Sahara, too, is that it is one of the largest dinosaur bone graveyards in the world. Just an incredible amount of dinosaur bones that have been excavated, but also an amazing amount that has yet to be discovered. It's very rich in this paleo material, dinosaur bones. And of course, one of the clues that this was a very subtropical, well-watered area just 7,000 years ago. This rock art dates from about 7,500 before present, and it's a sculpture of a big giraffe. And giraffes roamed all over this area. And of course, giraffes can't live in this climate today. It's just too dry. They don't have the resources. But back 7,000 years ago, you had giraffes and elephants and tigers, lions, all sorts of people and animals roaming around. And the rock art represents that period in recent geologic history. And of course, eventually it'll change again.
Did you take that picture yourself?
Yeah, I took all these pictures, yeah.
And where was this one?
This is in the Air Mountains in the middle northern part of Niger, right along the Libyan and Algerian and Nigerian border. It's about as far away from faraway places as you can get. It's remote. of course, moving people and goods around is difficult. And if you think about something as critically important to Africa as a region as HIV/AIDS, and you think about all of the educational and health challenges from AIDS, and then you just talk to some of these guys that are driving these trucks, well, they'll be on the road for 3 months at a time, driving literally across the Sahara from north to south, east to west. And of course, you know, they have a very different code of ethics, a very different take on life. You can understand how easy it is for AIDS to be spread through this environment. And there is very little infrastructure or support in many of these remote communities for education or for health treatment. And transportation plays a role in this. And one of the big questions, of course, is that if you improve accessibility, what types of challenges do you then create for the communities whose accessibility has been improved? Because now you have better contact with all of the issues that come from the outside world. And of course, AIDS is one of those. And anywhere in Africa where you've seen heightened interaction economically over the last 30 years, you've seen a parallel increase in HIV/AIDS infections. There's a clear correlation between greater integration and HIV/AIDS. And of course, if you don't have the infrastructure, the health, the education, the money, the drugs to address that, it becomes a problem. And in many of these African communities, HIV/AIDS infection rates are upwards of 25, 30, 35, 40%. There's a whole generation in Africa that's being lost because of this problem. Rock and roll in the Sahara, you gotta love this. As I said, the Tuareg are really nice people. They do love their music. This was a festival that was convened, a three-day festival out in the middle of nowhere, and all these guys turned up in these trucks. They got out their diesel generators, and they started cranking up the generator. Well, that's nice. They're going to have a cookout, you know, some steaks, barbecue, whatever. No, they get out the guitars, and they start tuning up and stuff, and they're going to have a rock and roll concert in the desert. And there were people that came from 3, 4, 5 days travel, that came from miles and miles around, all these different Tuareg tribes to come for this celebration. And we never figured out what it was. It was just like a celebration. They just got together and just had a really good time playing Tuareg rock and roll in the desert.
Just the men
or the women? Oh no, everybody got involved. Along the fringe of the Sahara, in places like the Sahel, you've got literally thousands of different ethno-linguistic groups. It's an incredibly complex region. This is just one small group that occupies an area of about 200 square miles, the Gurun Sea, and they have these beautiful villages where they do all of this war art, and they have really sort of an amazing relationship with the environment. And we had an opportunity to go down there and sleep in this luxury five-star hotel, which is actually sleeping bags on the roof of these little huts, and it was really an eye-opening experience because you got to see how the villagers sat around at night and how they talked about things that were in many ways very, very sophisticated. They had an understanding and a connection to the wider world that would put many of our students certainly to shame, but certainly many in our community. I mean, they were really sort of in touch with what was going on, and that was their nightly news. That was their Fox or their ABC or whatever it was. As they sat around and they talked about what was going on and who brought back this news from the town and the political information and the climate and what was going on. Really a fascinating insight into how these communities interact. Kids work really hard in the Sahel. Wherever you are, you saw kids working day and night. Their responsibility was looking after the cattle. It may have been goats or camels, whatever it was. Cotton in the background, a major cash crop for many of these communities in the Sahel region. But kids working all the time. You saw them 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, in the morning, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Kids were out working really hard. A couple of beers and you'll do just about anything actually this is not me in one of these masks, but one of the cultural dynamics of this region of the Sahel is these mask dances, and every village has its own style of mask. And this was one small village just to the south of Ouagadougou. And if you can't get excited about a town like Ouagadougou, right, I don't know what's going to get you excited. But these Bobo mass dancers were just incredible. They danced as though they were in a trance, which they may well have been because they were swilling a fair amount of the local beverage during this festival. But they had all these incredible masks that are handmade. Some of them are small like this. In the background, you can see some of these masks were like 8 foot tall, and they were heavy. And they put these things on, they'd be dancing around and falling over. I mean, that was probably the beer. But just the intricacy of these masks was incredible. And this is part of their cultural expression. This is part of describing who they are, and the festivals that are associated with these masks are very intricate. Different masks for weddings, funerals, just because it's Friday night, whatever the case may be, a mask for every purpose. And of course, you can't have a festival without music, and a lot of the musical styles, as we mentioned earlier, come out of this area. And you sit there and you start to listen to some of these rhythms, and you start thinking about, you know, Delta blues, jazz, Elvis Presley. You start to hear these rhythms because that's the sort of music they play. But it's really tough to describe because it doesn't have a real structure to it. It's a little bit like sort of jazz that's just played off the cuff, but it's really amazing music. We were searching for sand dunes, though. We were searching for sand dunes because we didn't see a sand dune for 2 weeks. And because we couldn't go to Chad or the Sudan, we ended up in the Silwa Oasis, which is right on the border of Libya and Egypt. And it's this really beautiful spot in the Saharan Desert, right near a sequence of lakes. And this is where you can go out and you can actually see Saharan dunes. You can finally go out and see sand dunes, right? The sorts of dunes that you expect. And it's a lot of fun just walking across these dunes and watching how the grains of sand move across the landscape. You know, you might think it's sort of boring just to sit there and watch the sand, but when the wind picks up, you can actually see the sand grains hopping. It's called saltation, and they actually hop across the landscape. And if you sit there long enough, you actually start to see these little mini dunes being built, you know, Barkhans or the edge dunes, and slowly but surely, the landscape shifts under your feet. Now, this is an incredibly dynamic landscape. It's never the same. It's always changing day after day, hour after hour, minute after minute. It's really an impressive landscape. Really appreciate you listening, coming out tonight. Be happy to answer any questions about this amazing place. And I'm going back there again real soon because it's an incredible place. It's far away, but it's really amazing. Thank you. We couldn't go into Chad for political reasons. Yeah, but the reason why we really wanted to go there, because Lake Chad has been shrinking at an incredible rate over the past couple of decades, and it would have really been cool to see what was actually happening there on the ground. But yeah, unfortunately we didn't get to that. Would have been nice. Next, well, now we can't even go to Niger this time because now the Tuareg are not being nice. Other questions? Don't be shy. Margaret?
You mentioned it's very rich in resources. Oil, you mentioned,
it's all tapped, but it's tapped by foreigners. It's all exploited and goes out of the country. So oil, gas, uranium, minerals, there's gold, there's molybdenum, there's a whole bunch of stuff. But of course, there's export crops. Most of these agricultural economies are based on export crops, so it's groundnuts like peanuts, it's cotton. Well, you can't eat a lot of cotton. You're gonna turn it into something. Well, most of these countries actually are net importers of foodstuffs now because so much of their agriculture is geared towards producing for the global marketplace export crops to generate cash revenue for the government, because it's the cash revenues that enable the government to buy military hardware or anything else that it needs. On the ground in the local communities, if you're growing cotton and you're not growing fruits and vegetables, then you got to import, you got to buy. So it's sort of an exploitive relationship that has its roots in the colonial period, and that's one of the reasons why Africa still remains the poorest region economically on the planet today, in part. Good question. Yes, sir.
On that 18-wheeler, what was in the bags?
In the bags was rice.
Rice
they were shipping from the south to the north. Yeah, a lot of rice. Yes, sir.
Since the Africans don't have control over the natural resources, is it misleading to call it the post-colonial period?
Well, I mean post-colonial period in the sense that the economic systems that were in place during the colonial period that took resources into the European economy or the Atlantic economy, those systems are still in place today. Now they're perhaps multinational corporations, they're perhaps companies that are controlled by the political elite in those countries. They're doing much the same things. So those resources are going out into the global marketplace, much as they did in the colonial period, but absolutely in a different political context. Now the people making those decisions are actually in the country, making decisions that are based on those relationships that have been around for a long time.
The United States has control of the resources of the Congo, and probably some of the Congolese are making decisions.
Well, you could argue that, I mean, yeah, you've got a point. I mean, there's all sorts of political relationships at play in all these countries. In fact, if you think about the Congo, all of the problems that it's had over the last couple of years, if you look at the economy of the Congo, very dependent on copper, right? Over the last few years, the demand for copper has plummeted because in telecommunications, we're not using copper in ground or landlines anymore because everyone's using cell phones. Right, so all of a sudden, all of that copper that was used in telecommunications for hard networks is not needed anymore. And so that aspect of the Congolese economy collapsed. And there are similar examples of resources throughout Africa that are going through those changes. And it's interesting to note which country is investing the most money in infrastructure and development today in Africa. It's China. China by a long shot. China just gave the Nigerian government $6 billion to develop infrastructure, whatever that might mean. So, you know, there are lots and lots of roads and oil pipelines, etc. You know, there's a lot of interesting political changes going on in Africa. It's really a dynamic place in terms of global politics. Yes, sir?
Did you ever feel threatened or fear for your safety at all?
Not really. I mean, we go in with an organization that basically has everything covered, is in pretty good shape. But you know, it's like traveling anywhere. When we went up into the Air Mountains, that shot you saw with the caravan, we had two trucks, one in the front, one in the back, six guys in each, submachine guns, fully loaded, armed, ready to roll. I mean, that's just what you have to have, just in case. Other than that, they're really nice people, yeah. But, you know, we were really more concerned about the Nigerian military than we were about the Tuareg, right? Because the Tuareg, they're really nice people. Yes, ma'am?
You said they brought news and discussed it at night. What sort of information is this?
Well, some of them did have cell phones, right? The wealthy people in the village. But, for example, if somebody had gone up to Ouagadougou, the capital, to the marketplace to sell something, they would bring news back. There would be news from relatives. They would sit around and talk about all sorts of things. They would know, somebody would have had access to a telegram, for example. They'd be talking about OJ tonight. You know, they God forbid, but you know, they would be in touch. They were having conversations about Chinese investment. And they were talking about what's going to happen to us, the Guaranxi, when the Chinese come in and start, you know, running our country and buying up businesses. I mean, they were very sophisticated in how they were thinking about the wider world and its impact on them as a small community of just a, you know, a few thousand people. It was pretty interesting. Yes?
The final photo, you were all in black. Did folks wear black or white? White supposed to be?
No, that was all that I had left that was clean. Look, 3 weeks in the desert, come on. You know, that was it.
Did the natives wear white?
No, the Tuareg are all blue. They wear blue. that's their outfit. When you go up into the North African area, Libya and Egypt, then white is a fairly dominant color. But now you see blue jeans and T-shirts and you know, Jordan and Tiger Woods apparel, and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. Good questions. Any more? One last question. I got Peggy. Just right.
So I'm assuming that in the desert area, you're going from oasis to oasis where the towns are located. About how far, should I say, in time did it take you to get from one place to the other in the desert?
It took from going up from Agadez to the Tuareg community it's about 70 miles. It took us 9 hours. Yeah, it can take 9 hours when there's a traffic jam on I-65 if you're going to Nashville. But, you know, yeah, I mean, 9 hours to do 70, 80 miles, that was fairly normal. You know, even on good paved roads, you're not going to average more than 25, 30 miles an hour in that area. I mean, things just don't move as fast.
So it's no faster than going by camel?
Probably not, actually. I mean, you know, camels can move along at a pretty good rate.
Is English spoken in any of these areas that you mentioned tonight?
Yeah, English isn't widely spoken. Actually, French was the dominant language in all the places we were in, so it helped to have a little bit of French. But most of the people that we work with that are in the tourism or economic side of the country would speak some English. Certainly in hotels and restaurants, people would have English as their basic second language. But most people were speaking French where we were, because most of that area, Mali and Chad, Niger, Burkina, part of French West Africa during the colonial period. But you can get around with English. Usually not a problem. Peggy had a question, and then we'll do the drawing.
Yeah. I wondered how a Westerner like you stays healthy and shows up restaurants. What in the name of creation?
Well, fortunately, I've got one of those cast iron stomachs, so if it's crawling or not, I'll eat it and I'm okay. on those types of tricks, you know, this is not hardship stuff. So we have, you know, people cooking food and the water's clean and stuff. So we take care of that stuff. But, you know, if you're traveling around by yourself, you know, you've got to take precautions because it can be difficult. And, you know, quite a few people had, you know, the usual funny tummy and, you know, water-related issues. But we're pretty careful when we do these trips. We have about 40 or 50 people on these trips. We're pretty careful about food and drink because, you know, nothing worse to ruin a trip than getting food or drink illnesses. So we're pretty careful about that stuff. Just drink beer in a bottle and you're fine. Right? All right, the drawing time. Someone's going to win a trip to... No. A book. Oh, Clive Cussler's book. The movie was really bad, but the book is really good. Really. Now, have you seen the movie? It was bad. All right, the lucky winner is John Stevens. There's John. Well done. All right. You get the Clive Cussler book. Well done. Well, thanks for coming, everybody. Appreciate it. Lots of more great talks coming up over the next six, seven months or so. Brian's the man here. We'll do all the advertising.
Before you go, I know you want to join us in thanking you. Peggy's here to...
I don't have a nice little turban for you to wear. Oh, I do have something to make you feel better.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks all for coming out. Having Uma Doraswamy, who's one of our own faculty at University Libraries, who's a native of Hyderabad, coming to talk to us about South India. So hope you'll join us then. Thanks and have a great evening.